authority was not upon the earth. We then started walking through Joseph Smith's ancestry and trying to get closer to Joseph, talking about gifts of the Spirit. You'll notice which one of Joseph's ancestors saw a pillar of light and heard his name. No. I knew it. We can never have vacation again. Okay, so it was Solomon Mack. We talked about Joseph Smith Sr. had how many visions or revelatory dreams before Joseph had his first?
Seven.
Good. Okay, we're in class. Thank you. And I was hoping to tell you about Lucy Mack Smith, the long-winded, didn't get there. So I thought I'd take a few minutes to talk a little bit about the gifts of the Spirit of Lucy. I'm only going to mention two so that you can see the variety of gifts that the family enjoy. In other words, this particular family knows that authority to act in the name of God is not upon the earth, you know, to some extent. They also know that they believe in revelations, they believe in lights, they can hear voices, they can have revelatory dreams. And in the case of Lucy Mack Smith, two examples to show that her gifts differ from that of other family members. One story goes like this. When Lucy was a young married woman, a doctor came and concluded that Lucy was dying. And so Joseph Smith Sr., her husband, now hurries into the bedroom and his opening line to his wife was, "My dear wife, you must die." So you realize his counseling techniques are very poor, but definitely he comes to the point. Lucy becomes, as she writes about it, very upset about with her husband. She tells him to get out of the room. And then Lucy describes herself making a covenant with God. Notice this is when priesthood is not upon the earth, but Lucy believes herself capable of making a covenant. She makes a covenant with God that she will yet love that husband, and that she will bear children, and she will teach her children to fear God, which in our vernacular would equate to love God. It will be then that she describes that she hears scriptures being quoted to her. And the scripture was, "Seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you." Why is this significant? When we meet next time, we're going to find that Joseph Smith had many different accounts of the first vision. And in one of those accounts, he describes that when he was young, not only had he read James 1 and 5, but he describes that he learned in his youth that if he would seek, he could find. If he would knock, it would be opened unto him. So in other words, we're trying to reinforce that a family was being prepared for a prophet to be born in their family line as much as Joseph will prepare them for the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and the establishment of the church. One more on Lucy to get an idea of her personality. Lucy, this one takes place when she has moved to Palmyra and she's been baptized and she belongs to the Western Presbyterian Church in town. For Lucy, by this point, she's read in the Bible that in her mind, you can't get to heaven unless you've been baptized. And so for Lucy, she's been baptized, but her husband, Joseph Smith Sr., has refused any such ordinance. For Lucy, she now starts bugging him. You realize there's a fine line between repeating something twice and nagging. I know how to pass that line, and I imagine for most of the women, as the years come and go, you'll get it down too. But nevertheless, Lucy now is nagging her husband, and finally he's strong. He refuses to be baptized into any of the churches in Palmyra. She describes herself going out into the woods, what we call the sacred grove, and she says she always gets answers out there, but she describes on this particular occasion, she did not, as she now pleads with the Lord, soften the heart of my husband. And she's actually been to her local minister. She's asked the minister, "Hey, can you baptize my husband, even though you know he'll never show up at church?" And the minister said, "Oh, sure." So, Lucy is kind of, now she's at her wit's end. She says she doesn't get an answer, but that night she has a dream. She describes herself seeing two beautiful trees that were identical, kind of like chiclet gums. You know, you always know what you're going to get out of the package. And there's no surprise shape. And so she said, the tree, she said, nothing could be as beautiful as she saw these trees. She then describes that she sees a wind starting to blow. One of the trees hates the wind and becomes like marble. Even the leaves do not even respond as the wind picks up kind of speed. She then describes that the other tree, however, enjoys the wind, laughs over, picks up kind of a brook that's going by, eventually gets a beautiful white base around the bend. She then describes after this dream of trees that she gets out of bed and she pleads with the Lord for the interpretation. Now you realize if it had been me, I would have wondered what I had eaten. You know, I wasn't running. How could this be? You know, trees and all that. But for Lucy, she asks the Lord, what's the interpretation? And the answer she receives is, did you see the two trees? One is your husband and one's your husband's brother that's a minister. In other words, Lucy, are you thinking that you married in the right family? Just one removed. And you know, she'd been so darn impressed by this minister. But Lucy, did you see the wind? The wind's the true gospel. When the true gospel is upon the earth, the man you so admire, you know, the minister, brother-in-law, he won't accept it. It'll become like marble, it'll be like rock. But did you see your husband? He's the other tree. He'll lap over, he'll pick up like the living water of Christ. He'll have a beautiful white band. In other words, hey, lady, back off. Give your husband a chance. When the true gospel is upon the earth, he will be baptized. So you begin to look and you say, here's a family, even before the 19th century, that have enjoyed many gifts of the Spirit. Now I need to put the family together this hour, get Joseph and Lucy married, get children coming into their home, and get us to Sharon, Vermont, and the story goes like this. We start first with Joseph Smith Sr. Joseph Smith Sr. was living in a place called Tunbridge, Vermont. While living in Tunbridge, you would describe him as a very eligible bachelor. For him, what made him such an eligible bachelor was that he actually owned 100 acres. Now, it was viewed back then, if you owned 100 acres, you could have a normal life. You could marry, you could have children, you wouldn't have to worry about a second job, that you could, it wouldn't matter how many kids the woman had, that you'd be able to support your family if you had 100 acres. Well, for Joseph Smith Sr., prior to his marriage, he actually owns 100 acres, which makes him an eligible bachelor. How does Lucy get to Tunbridge, Vermont? Well, she has a brother that owns a general store in Tunbridge, and she decides kind of on a lark for like a summer that she will go out and help as a, like a sales clerk in the general store. So what you're picking up from this, it does matter where you shop. And, you know, so he will find her in the store. They fall in love and they get married. Now, when they marry, you'd say the best, most expensive wedding gift that Lucy Mack receives for her marriage is from her brother that she works for in the general store. Stephen Mack and his partner give Lucy $1,000. So for you, you know, when your brother or sister gives you a frying pan or dish towels, please let them know that that is unacceptable. That way back in the 19th century, even Lucy Mack Smith received $1,000 from a sibling. Now, the $1,000 meant that Lucy had a private purse. Back then, you know, 99% of the women in the U.S. were beholden to their husbands for any kind of change, and they needed to be accountable for it. But there were very few women that had a private purse, meaning they had their own money. So you would look at Lucy and Joseph Smith Sr., and it wasn't like they were the country club set, but it seemed obvious to everyone they would be, and perhaps even one day philanthropic. So it's kind of like two people with money found each other. Well, all right, they move on to Joseph Smith Sr.'s farm there in Tunbridge, and children begin coming. Oldest child, can you name him? Good, okay, Alvin now comes, and we'll have many occasions to talk about Alvin, but we know that Joseph Smith said of his brother Alvin that he was the most handsomest man he had ever seen next to Adam and Seth. So you've got Alvin Smith, the oldest, and then comes Hiram. Well, okay, for Joseph Smith Sr., suddenly he realizes, well, my wife is fertile. I'm going to have a whole bunch of kids. I'd like to live, actually, a pretty big lifestyle. In other words, a well-to-do lifestyle. And so his conclusion was he wanted more than just 100 acres. He rented his farm and moves his wife and two children to a place called Royalton, Vermont. Now, the state of Vermont, very small, and all of these places pretty much within about 20 miles of each other. In Royalton, Vermont, Joseph Smith Sr. is moved there because he's hoping to increase his kind of business enterprise. He has a man there that wants to form a partnership, and Joseph Smith Sr. buys into it, kind of like hook, line, and sinker. So much so that Joseph Smith Sr. goes in debt, which debt becomes a big item back then, and we'll talk more about it, but he goes in debt to form a partnership. And what this partnership wants to do, they actually have learned that in China. So we always think about ourselves international economy now. It actually was then too. But they had heard back in China, you know, far, far away, that the Chinese really liked something grown in the United States, and it was something called ginseng root. What the Chinese would use the ginseng root for, they would use it for an ingredient in perfume for women, and they would also put it in various medicines. So ginseng root had two purposes. One, you smell good, or two, medicinal purposes. You would feel good if you chewed on this root. They, you know, made it powder, they added it into something. And so Joseph Smith Sr. and his partner chartered a ship. They filled the whole ship with ginseng root and sent it then off to China with the idea, you know, their ship is coming in, bonanza. It's like they were just going to almost like win the lottery over such an amazing business idea. Well, it turned out that the root sold for a fortune, and Joseph Smith Sr.'s partner became well-to-do and immediately will skip town. But not before telling Joseph Smith Sr. that that ship that had all their ginseng root, that, you know, there'd been a horrible accident, the ship's at the bottom of the ocean, and everything they had hoped for is now lost. So you realize Joseph Smith Sr. is deceived. And with that deception, he now, as he'd gone out on a limb, he now owes $1,800. Now, for any of you as you graduate from BYU, if you only owed $1,800, you would feel so blessed. I mean, how is that possible? But back then, if you owed money, you were then viewed as a debtor. And in the United States at that time, we had 70,000 men in jail called debtors' prisons. And so how you got out of jail, you had to get family or friends that would put up the money, and then you could get out. So you'd say it's so much different. Today, they go, hey, if you just pay 10 bucks a month, we'll keep you forever. But back then, it was, you know, do not pass go, you go straight to jail. Joseph Smith Sr. is now in big trouble as suddenly his partner has absconded and all money is gone. For Joseph Smith Sr., he now puts up his farm for sale that was back there in Tunbridge, Vermont, and he sells it for $800. He still owes $1,000. Who has $1,000? Okay, Lucy has $1,000. It's her private purse. She saved it. And now he goes to her and says, you've got a choice. One, keep your own money, but I'm going straight to jail. For Lucy, obviously the choice isn't a good choice, but she gives the $1,000 to her husband. In the meantime, she's had child three, Sophronia. So try and imagine if you have no money, you have no land, and you're Joseph Smith Sr., you have a wife and three children, where can you go and that you will not take your entire family homeless? Hey, where do you go? You go back to parents, right? And, well, I won't ask where those have done this, you know, but where those that anticipate. Oh, sure. You know, so the parents that they choose to go to, the most well-to-do of Aziel Smith and Solomon Mack will be Solomon Mack. Solomon Mack lives in a place called Sharon, Vermont. And so Solomon Mack, he actually has 600 acres. So you'd say he's very well-to-do for the time period, particularly in his case when he's been so accident-prone. So suddenly, Lucy is now sent word, I'm coming home with what appeared to be, you know, what a bright light. Look who you married. You know, whoosh, I got one daughter off the dole. To suddenly, we're coming back, and by the way, we've got three kids. For Solomon Mack, he's not excited to have young kids running under feet. And so his conclusion is he will put Lucy and Joseph Smith Sr. on land he has for sale. Now, in other words, he's trying to get rid of some of these 600 acres. He's got a log cabin. In other words, I like my daughter enough, I'm willing to let her and her family live in my log cabin, but for sure they're not living in the farmhouse with the rest of us. So Lucy, Joseph Smith Sr., three kids move into the farmhouse, and Joseph Smith Sr. is now a renter. Now, for you, many of you are renters, and actually, if you made your payments, kept it clean, Raintree wants you there forever. You know, I mean, you're the perfect person, Riviera, wherever it is, perfect. They want you to stay there always. You've got a contract. But if you're a renter in the 19th century and you're out in farmland, it means you're on land that is for sale. And renters, beware. You improve that land. You put in crops. You put in a fence. You're going to bless the owner because the moment it's sold, you're out of there. So a renter basically has no rights. And for Joseph Smith Sr., he will be a renter for the next 15 years. So he is a renter from 1803 until 1818. And, you know, I can't think of any of us that are going, wow, that's what I want. No, no, you know, you guys, you want the American dream, you know, the 17-car garage, you know, the Humvee, the, you know, Mercedes, the, you know, okay, I mean, you know, that's we all want the American dream. But in the case of Joseph Smith Sr., it's going to elude him for 15 years. Okay, while he's living there in Sharon, Vermont, we come to December 23rd, 1805. Look at you guys. Okay, you'd say Lucy Max Smith is about to be delivered of a child. There are two people present in the cabin at the time, Lucy and then a local doctor. And the doctor's name was Joseph Adam Dennison. And for Lucy, you know, you'd think, here's this big buildup from John Lathrop, and even before that, that truly would she recognize that her fourth child would be different than the other children. I mean, that he had this amazing destiny like Joseph of Egypt. And for Lucy Mack Smith, she does not. Much like your parents probably didn't know your greatness. But you'd say for Lucy Mack Smith, all she wrote of the birth of young Joseph, she wrote, in the meanwhile. I mean, in the meanwhile does not sound like, you know, the trumpets, the action, you know, we know, okay. She writes, in the meanwhile, she said, I gave birth to my fourth child, third son, so Alva and Hiram, you know, and now Joseph. And she said, and I named him after his father, Joseph Smith Jr. So why she doesn't name the first one, I have no idea. But she names his fourth child, Joseph Smith Jr. The other person that wrote about the birth was the local doctor, this Dr. Dennison. He kept a day book, which looks a lot like an Excel spreadsheet with three columns. One column, here's the date. Middle column, here's the medical service rendered. Last column, here's how he's paid, typically in produce at the time. He will then write that, you know, here's the date, delivered child, received produce. But years later, he will write in that same line, if I had known what this baby was to become, I would have smothered the cuss. So notice it appears that mom is clueless as to Joseph's destiny, as well as local doctor. Well, it's not long after Joseph is born that the land on which they had been living in Sharon, Vermont, owned by Solomon Mack, in other words, Joseph's born on Grandpa's property, it is not long until that land is now sold out from underneath Joseph Smith Sr., and he now needs to move. Notice he's always a renter, and we can name 11 different places that he lived before he ever moved to Western New York in Palmyra. In other words, you describe him almost like a nomadic farmer. Part of the reason that he's moving is that you'd say from spring to harvest time, he's always out by the river. The river that runs through that part of Vermont is called the Connecticut River. You know, an odd name for the name of the state, Vermont. But nevertheless, Joseph Smith Sr., he always goes out to the river from spring to fall. And then in the winter, he always takes his family and moves into a local town. Because in the town, you can get, like, your second job. In a town, you can be a sheriff, you can be, you know, an accountant, you can be, you know, the local maker of glass, you know, whatever it is, to kind of supplement what your farm produce didn't bring in for the year. And so you'd say for Joseph Smith Sr., he lives out by the Connecticut River, moving all the time on rented property, and then he stops in during the winter months in a local town. How he supports himself? He supports himself as a school teacher. Now, I can speak to the fallacy of that. But nevertheless, okay, that's always his second income. He's not a blacksmith, he's not a sheriff, he's not the banker, he's not a doctor. He's always a school teacher. Now, of those towns he moves to, you'd say there's good news about towns and there's bad news about towns. The good news about towns is that suddenly your sister isn't as cute to you after all. You know, in other words, wow, you stay out on that farm pretty much, and even mom is looking good. And so, you know, you got to get in those towns to stop inbreeding, got it? So you get in the towns, and, you know, here come all the farmers, and you're like, oh, there's Susie and there's Joni. Okay, so towns, if you're going to fall in love and get married, it's going to be in the winter, and it's always in the towns. You'd say, what else is good in towns is you have socials, you have organized churches, you know, you have new occupations. You know, one day you're a farmer, next day you're a doctor. Okay, so that's good on towns. What's bad on towns is that the people who have to live in towns all year long are poor, kind of like the Cratchits. Okay, we all remember, if you're handicapped, you're stuck in a town, you know. You may want to get to a city, big city, because you might have more opportunities. But these little towns in Vermont will keep the poor there often. And you'd say, if you're ever going to be robbed, it's in the town. You know, a robber is not going to rob you out on the farm and then have to go, you know, several miles to find the next farmer. He's going to wait till you bring in all your money into the bank. So if you're ever going to see the transient bad guys, it's going to be in the town. Fires go in town. Things are bad. What's the worst thing that could hit any town? And the answer is epidemics. And so the one town that we know the most about that Joseph Smith Sr. moves to is a town called West Lebanon, New Hampshire, still about 20 miles from Sharon, Vermont. In other words, Betty's horseback ride that, hey, Grandpa, we need it. We got to get back. So the place is West Lebanon, New Hampshire. Notice it's not war-torn Lebanon, but it's West Lebanon, okay. As they're in that town, suddenly a kind of epidemic communicable disease that's running everywhere through town is something called typhus fever. The first in the Smith family to get it will be Joseph Smith Sr.'s daughter, Sophronia. And so a local doctor made house calls. Local doctor did not have the black bag with all the tools, but local doctor always had a wagon with placards. So the doctor slash farmer, 9 months of the year, comes in, he checks out Sophronia, and his conclusion is, wow, she's got this amazing, you know, kind of epidemic illness. And when he concludes that, he always carried in his wagon placards, kind of like a real estate guy. But he would then put the placard in the ground, and in this case, it would say quarantine, meaning that no one could go into that house and no one could come out of the house until the doctor had tracked the illness. He would then take off the placard, and suddenly you could still fraternize with your neighbors. will notice, you probably all had an occasion to get the flu or sore throat. I know when my husband would cough, I would say, how could you? I know I'm getting this. And, you know, so anytime you're trapped in any environment with people that are sick, it's not going to be long till you have strep throat or bronchitis or whatever they're passing along. So sophronia gets typhus fever, and it isn't long until all children in the family get it. In other words, Alvin, Hiram, Joseph, and now we're starting to get more. So, okay, it does appear that mom and dad are now immune from the illness. In other words, obviously they either had it in the past, something, but they seem to survive it pretty well. They would say for family members, one by one, they all got well with no lasting implications. In other words, some of you may say, I once had chicken pox, but I say, oh, you look normal. You survived something that could have been an epidemic in a different time, or measles was a huge epidemic back then. And you say, well, you know, I had that, but it was trapped in our house, and it's now solved. Well, the only family member that had difficulty that would impact his life for the rest of his life was young Joseph Smith Jr. So at the time, he's 7 years old. Now, okay, you all realize this typhus fever, your fever goes incredibly high. We've all had high fevers, and typically when the fever is ended, you usually get some kind of fever blisters, and typically you get it on your lips. And people will say to you, you know, you don't look good, and you say, but you know, I feel so much better. In other words, the illness is almost over. It's just on my lips. You know, I actually don't even have a headache. But you'd say in the case of young Joseph, as the fever started to subside, he had a blister that appeared on his right shoulder blade. Now, the blister was so large that Lucy Mack Smith insisted that a local doctor be called in and lance it. Now, the method they used back then, and we've got to all be grateful for modern medicine, but the method they used back then was called the shot shovel method. And what it meant was you take your shovel that you had used on the farm, you heat it up in hot coals, and you place it, in Joseph's case, on the back of his right shoulder blade to see if you could lance then the blister. Now, you realize it's going to work. You know, you take something that's kind of red hot. Okay, well, okay. I mean, you know, how can you miss? It's, you know, sure save method. But, you know, the blister then lanced. Lucy, I've got to assume she was, you know, making it sound bigger and worse, but she indicated as much as 2 pints of pus came out of that blister. And I do hope you have a good lunch. All right, so, okay. So the blister now is lanced, and Joseph appears to have no more problems on his right shoulder. However, a blister appears above his left ankle. Doctor called in, Dr. Very Crude Shot Shovel Method, and he does it again and again and again as the blister continues, you know, a new one reappears. Finally, doctor/farmer concludes that, whoops, could this be above my medical knowledge? Okay, and so, you know, you're always grateful when the GP sends you to a specialist. You're like, oh, thank you. You know, so, you know, in other words, it's above the flu. It's above, you know, strep throat. You know, I've got this blister that, in his case, keeps coming back. The result will be is that the local doctor goes to a medical school that's just a few miles away. Can you name it? Dartmouth. Now, Dartmouth was famous back then. Dartmouth, obviously, much more famous today. Any of you would-be doctors, you get into Dartmouth Medical School, you are your parents' retirement plan. You know, they're counting on you. I mean, this is amazing. Well, okay. Local doctor goes to see a professor. His name was Nathan Smith. Is he related to Joseph? Perhaps way back when, but nothing close. Nathan Smith gets excited. In other words, there's one thing to show students charts. There's quite another to show a live specimen. And so local professor from Dartmouth Medical School will take as many as 11 interns to go there into West Lebanon, New Hampshire, to be able to see young Joseph. Well, between doctors and interns, Their conclusion was, in order to save the boy's life, his foot must be cut off above his ankle. Their reasoning was is that the bone between the disease and a very crude shot shovel method used, that the bone was diseased. And so at this point, as they make the conclusion, then obviously Joseph and family want to know, is there not another way? Because what would happen if you cut off the boy's foot? You'd make him forever in one of these small towns. I mean, he couldn't marry. I mean, how could he support a wife? How could he support little children? You know, you'd make him, he'd be stuck to a town. You realize if that were to happen to any of you, you know, you'd obviously need counseling for years, if not the rest of your life. But more than that, you realize most of you are here in school so you can get a desk job anyway. You know, it's not like you're here so you can be out and be farmers and fresh air. You know, you're here because you're going to be the head of some factory or whatever it is. You know, you're gonna have that desk job. Well, okay, so for the Smiths, they now want to know, as does Joseph, is there not another way? So you realize at a medical school there is always another way. It's just if you're willing to be the experimentee. You know, I don't want to say that they're always on the cutting edge, but actually that's pretty much where they're at. You know, they don't mind seeing garden variety stuff, but something new, and we're willing to try something new, and that's medical schools. Well, okay. So they said, well, I'll tell you what we'd be willing to do. We'd be willing to cut out that diseased portion of the bone and then sew your leg up and see if it works. And then if it doesn't work, then to spare your life, then we'll do Operation B, cut off your foot above the ankle. So family now agrees on Operation A. According to the Dartmouth Medical School records, the operation occurred at the college. Now, that makes lots of sense to me, as it probably does to you. But Lucy Mack Smith writes that it occurred at the home, and that's the one that's picked up in all the little primary books. So that one has emotion, and I now tell you that one, and you go, yes, I love it. It's bedtime stories. I know this one. So the one, you've got two accounts. One is Mom and her memories many years later, and the other is kind of a permanent record at the medical school. So Mom's account goes like this. She said it occurs in the home in which they've been renting that winter. And she said that the doctor, then this Nathan Smith, was going to operate in the upstairs bedroom. She described that the doctor wanted Joseph to take some kind of alcoholic beverage like whiskey to deaden the pain, but indicated that Joseph would not, that he would be fine if who held him? His father. Look at you guys. You know this part. Okay, that if Dad holds me, hey, I'll be fine. Okay, she then describes that the doctor begins to operate. Now, there's one thing to say, I'm great if Dad holds me. There's quite another to have the guy with the saw cutting into your leg and about to take out part of the bone. Lucy describes that Joseph begins crying, just uncontrolled screaming. Lucy describes herself running into the bedroom, telling the doctor to stop. There's a reason they have a parent's waiting room. And so Lucy is now saying, you're done, you know, stop, that's enough. The doctor tells her that he cannot possibly stop and tells her if she can't stand the scream that she is to now leave the home. She describes herself going about a half a mile not to hear the screams of her son. Well, when the operation was over, we would all pronounce it as a success. In other words, Joseph will live about 31 years after the operation and will have 2 feet. He can run, he can jump, the mark, kind of a game, and you would say he appears to be, to many, athletic. So you would say it was a success. Were there downsides? And I'd say, oh yeah. All the days of Joseph's life, he walked with a limp. In other words, you know, if you were to see him coming towards you, he would favor the left side. So he always walked with a limp, the limp at one point so severe that when he attempted to join the Far West Militia, he will be denied it because of the severity of the limp. In other words, who could have gotten one of those coveted handicapped parking spaces, you know, and you say, oh, Joseph Smith, he had a limp on the left side. What else was a downside? Lucy described that this son, then 7, became so reduced in weight that she could carry him about with ease. Now think of 7-year-old brothers, nephews that would grow to be 6 feet tall. And you realize after a few moments of carrying them, you're like, hey, you got 2 feet, move out. And, you know, but in the case of Lucy, she says, I carry the son about with ease. You'd say, but the son's weight, Joseph's, became so reduced that he was actually sent out to live with an uncle for a time out in Salem, Massachusetts. An old kind of wives' tale back then was that sea breezes could bring better health than just kind of, you know, land that was landlocked. Okay, in addition, when Joseph's back home, we know that for 4 years he walked with some kind of crutch or crutches. Now, I think about it for a moment. Those of us that have been with crutches, you know, you walk with crutches and pretty soon you've got an amazing upper body, right? And, okay, for Joseph Smith, he was incredibly strong. He very much enjoyed playing a game of sticks that some of you may have played at Aaronic Priesthood commemorations, where you get one guy on one side and one on the other. You have a stick in between. You put your feet together. You rock back and forth. I was demonstrating this once with a football player from a local high school, and I don't think I've ever been thrown so far. You know, I was just trying to show him, now you do this, and then the one the strongest, you can lift the other guy to the feet, and I'm just, boom. You know, I'm just almost in flight. But he'd say for Joseph Smith, even into Nauvoo when he was in his 30s, he would say, line up 4 men on the opposite side of me, and we'll play this game. And he could lift the 4 men to a standing position. So you would see he was he had a very, very strong upper body, and he attributed to those 4 years with crutches. Was there one more downside? One downside was this. She realized the family, especially because they're farmers, Joseph's always walking on uneven ground, maybe in some of those small towns. But he describes that while he walked on this uneven ground, that he would fall down and invariably, where the incision had been, it would kind of open up. And he said that as many as 14 pieces of bone came out of the original incision. So you'd say, what's the doctor or doctors done? It was like they didn't do the clean cut you get with today's machines that, yeah, you know. You'd say, what did the doctor do? Well, he shattered the leg. And so all of you would-be attorneys, you'd say, I take that lawsuit. I mean, can you imagine the kid, what he's been through and shattered and bone keeps coming out 4 years later? But no, it's the 19th century, and the family were just grateful that Joseph all his days had his foot. Now, okay, moving on. So of all the little towns that Joseph Smith Sr. lived in, the only kind of real kind of get into it where we could say episode of Joseph's youth goes to the leg operation. We now move the family to a place called Norwich, Vermont, which continues to be 20 miles from, you know, as a kind of circumference from this Sharon, Vermont, or Solomon map. While living in Norwich, Joseph Smith Sr. is in big economic trouble. The problem that he faces is that for 3 years, he hasn't been able to have a harvest. And you realize any supplemental efforts as a school teacher does not cut it as more and more children are coming. And for Joseph Smith Sr., 3 years, lots of snow, it's always called years without a summer. Joseph Smith Sr. concludes it's time to quit the state of Vermont. In other words, you know how you can stay in one place and you try as hard as you can, and finally you go, you know, I'd rather pull up stakes and start over than to say, because I'm not doing good at all in this economy. Well, Joseph Smith Sr. was not alone in the year 1816. In the year 1816, 60,000 people quit the state of Vermont. In other words, we're out of here. They're experiencing crop failure. He's not alone in it. And the question is, where can they go to succeed? Well, okay, the place they want to go is they want to go west. When you and I are thinking west, We're thinking good. We're thinking California. We're thinking really good. We got the islands out there somewhere. Hawaii sounds wonderful. Okay, so that's west. But when the people were thinking west, most of the people were living in what was still then the 13 colonies. So when you say west, you're thinking Western Carolinas. You're thinking Western Virginia, or you're thinking Western New York. Now, where the people are going to go from Vermont, they're going to go to Western New York, including A.C.L. Smith will go to St. Lawrence, New York, and Joseph Smith Sr., eventually Palmyra, New York. Now, why they're thinking Western New York was that the easiest way to travel back then was always by water. You know, you travel by land, oh, you're going to wreck one of your wheels, you're going to get lost in the forest, but if you could get on a waterway, you could go for miles. So the whole United States wanted to be able to claim land out west, such as Western New York or Western Carolinas, and their conclusion was the only way to open up that land is we need a waterway. And so suddenly born was the idea we could open up Western New York first if we were to dig a big ditch. What's another name of the big ditch? Erie Canal. And suddenly we could open up that part of the nation for settlement. Well, okay. That part of the nation, Western New York, was owned by old veterans of the Revolutionary War. And the old veterans, you know, they had bounty land out there, but they just couldn't get to it. They didn't want to leave Boston or Philadelphia or New York or Staten Island, but they were sure willing to get money for their bounty lands, which were about 160 acres, they had received for fighting in the Revolutionary War. Well, all right, people that call themselves land speculators will now kind of interact with old veterans and say, do you own land along the proposed Erie Canal? In other words, I don't care if you own at other places, but along the proposed Erie Canal. There's one man we're going to feature that was a land speculator. Today we give him a much more ignoble title and we call him land developer. But land speculators, the man we're going to feature is a man named John Swift. John Swift interacts with old veterans. He then acquires property, goes out along the proposed Erie Canal. He claims his property, puts in Main Street. You know, and this is how you get Main Street USA is born. It's out there in that Western New York. But he puts in Main Street in his town, and he calls his town Swift's Landing with the idea, you know, you're going to want to settle in Swift's Landing because you won't just sell your farm goods to your neighbors, but you can sell it to people that come up and down on the soon-to-be Erie Canal on barges, and, you know, you make double your profits. Well, okay, John Swift's pretty excited about it, but basically few come to his town. Finally, John Swift, entrepreneurial friends get together and they go, what's the issue? Why isn't anybody coming here? And the conclusion was, the name of your town is just darn boring. Swift's Landing. The conclusion was, people that go west, even from Vermont, you're going to get the man of the household will come west if he likes it. He will return and get his wife and sweetheart, and sometimes that person will be one and the same. So, you know, they said the way you're going to attract men is you've got to name your town after a woman. In other words, how do you get all these little proposed towns that are popping up on this proposed Erie Canal, how do you get the man there? And the answer is you name your town after a woman. Well, one suggestion was, great, let's call it Martha after Martha Washington. Well, Martha Washington had been seen, and everyone concluded, no one will come to this town. In other words, you know, it can't be named after Martha. Well, what about Betsy Ross? No, I've seen her too. You know, it can't be, you know, the best way we're going to get men to come to this town, we need to name our town after a mythological goddess. You know, then the single man will come, and then he'll go back, get his wife, sweetheart. Well, you know, Venus had already been taken, Other names had already been taken, and suddenly somebody in this entrepreneurial meeting said, "Hey, I got a name." He said, I think people will come to this town." He goes, "It's after an old Syrian goddess. They had it in Egypt. Why don't you name this town what? Palmyra." So you can never just say Palmyra. And it's like, Palmyra, you know, she was amazing. And people will begin to come, including Joseph Smith Sr. So I hope you like the details. Are you, you know, for me, here's the gospel. And if I fill in all the details, I go, "Oh my gosh, it's this huge puzzle." And suddenly, do I know it's true? Well, absolutely, everything lines up.